You're listening to audio from Riverside Church. If you would like to check out more resources, please visit our website, riverside.church.
Well, good morning again, and welcome to Riverside. As Susan said, my name's Keith. I'm one of the leaders around this place, and I'm so glad you're here with us this Easter Sunday. Easter really is about life and death, life and death. And this morning, I actually want to start on the death side, if you will. I did some research this week on the funeral industry. It's interesting, you and I, we don't typically like to think about death that much. Most Americans, we ignore death at all costs. But when it happens, we spend a lot of money on it. One executive in the coffin business said this. He said, he's very optimistic because of the increased numbers of people who will die in the United States over the next 35 years. He said he literally expects a forecast of growth in the deceased. It's kind of an interesting phrase. Forecast of growth in the deceased. And because baby boomers, they're the next ones coming up, they want to go out in style. There's this growing trend in the industry of what's called designer caskets. They run up to around $20,000. You can get university caskets like that one, the Ohio State. Michigan people can't afford it, Dale. But Michigan can't afford it. But you can get a casket in your alma mater colors. In fact, at Ohio State this past year, at the homecoming game, they sold these caskets. At Ohio State, when they say homecoming, they mean homecoming, you know what I'm saying? There's online companies like FortressPersonal.com that advertise what they call the world's best and most affordable personal mausoleums. That's a creepy marketing picture. I don't know. You can even go to Costco, I'm dead serious about this, and buy a casket. And what's crazy about the Costco website is you can actually get either standard shipping or expedited shipping. Now, I mean, just think about this. I mean, you're in Costco, you get a big old bag of peanuts, and you get the big old bag of strawberries, and you're going, hey, Shelly, casket, what do you think? Standard shipping or expedited? Let's go expedited. I mean, it's just a weird thing. It's amazing how much money our culture spends on death, while at the same time, we spend so little attention to it, especially little attention to what comes after death. Now, that's not always been true. For many generations, when parents tucked their kids in for bed at night, they would say this little prayer. Many of you know this prayer, and they teach their kids this. Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. That's a creepy prayer to teach your kid. Would you agree? Yes, I know one person was taught that, like, never again. It's a creepy way to send a kid to bed. Think about that last line. There's actually a second verse to this prayer as well. The second verse literally goes like this. Our days begin with trouble here. Our life is but a span. And cruel death is always near, so frail thing is a man. Good night, honey. Sweet dreams. And people taught their kids to pray this. It's because they wanted their kids to know that death is real. And death is cruel. And death can't be avoided. And while we try to ignore death, many people around the world can't. I don't know if you looked at the news this morning, but over 200 people in Sri Lanka this morning lost their lives in a coordinated attack on churches and hotels. Over 200 people died this Easter morning, intentionally on Easter morning, at churches and hotels. See, we don't think much about death, but the rest of the world, it's front and center in their eyes, and they don't have the ability to ignore it like you and I try to. Yet you and I, we're not completely insulated from death and pain. I mean, for some of you, there's a lot of hurt, there's a lot of pain, maybe even some death inside of you or your family right now. I mean, for some of you, you got bad news this month. Now, someone you love is very sick, maybe it's even you. Or maybe it's just pain, maybe your job is shifting not for the better, or maybe your dream marriage has turned into a nightmare. Maybe a close friendship has gone sideways. Maybe the principal at your kid's school called, and they didn't call to say he or she made the honor roll. You know what I mean? And we've all been in these types of seasons where you get bad news and where life is painful and life is hard. Life sometimes even filled with death. And in these seasons, if I'm honest, even as a pastor, I sometimes wonder how the phrase, he's risen indeed, it doesn't, How does it really intersect with my life right now when it feels like death and pain and isolation? He's risen indeed, as we shouted earlier. I don't always see that. I don't always experience that. In fact, a lot of life feels more like a slow death, doesn't it? A lot of life feels more like a slow death. The more you live it, the more you realize how painful life can be. It's a lot of tension in life. A lot of tension in death. And to help us dive into this tension, we're going to look at a story in the Bible about life and death. It's from John chapter 11. Have your Bibles open up there, John chapter 11. And this story involves Jesus and his good friend Lazarus. It's one of his best friends, Lazarus. And Lazarus lived with his sisters, Mary and Martha. Their house was in a place called Bethany. It's kind of like a suburb of Jerusalem, if you will. And the last time Jesus was in Bethany, some religious leaders tried to stone him. The last time Jesus was in Bethany, they tried to kill him. And so Jesus has been run out of town. He's left the area. But then his good friend Lazarus got sick. We don't know what it was. Maybe he got a fever. Maybe he coughed up some blood. Maybe he found a lump or something. We don't know what his sickness was, but we know it was pretty bad. I picture Lazarus going to get whatever medical help was available back in those days. When he got there, the doctors just shook their head and they said, Lazarus, there's nothing we can do. You're going to die. You're going to die. And his sisters, Mary and Martha, they're desperate. They're so desperate. And they have only one hope. The doctor said there's no more hope. So there's only one hope in their mind. And so the sisters sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is sick. And they know Jesus can heal. They've seen Jesus heal people before. He's healed total strangers who don't even deserve it. And since Lazarus is such a good friend of Jesus, they don't even have to mention his name. Do you see that? The one you love. The one you love. I mean, surely Jesus will raise, will heal, will bless the one he loves. If he'll heal total strangers, why would he not heal the one he loves? And so in verse 4, when Jesus heard this, he said, this sickness will not end in death. No, it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. And spoiler alert, this is a very weird statement because Lazarus does die. Lazarus dies. That's a weird statement, Jesus. It's also weird. God's going to get the glory through you saying he's not going to die, but then he's going to die. Like, now, when we get to the end of the story, it's going to make sense. But initially, this is a very weird statement because, in fact, Lazarus does die. And not only that, but Jesus does something else that seems very weird, peculiar. At first glance, it seems contradictory. To me, honestly, it seems even cold-hearted. What Jesus does next seems to me very cold-hearted. Verse 5 states, Jesus loved Martha. He loved her sister Mary, and he loved Lazarus. I mean, Jesus loved this family. He loved them so much. Yet, verse 6, when he heard his good friend was sick and on death's bed and in agony, Jesus decided to hang around where he was for 2 more days. Does that seem weird? I mean, if someone you love, something goes wrong, you hear there's an emergency and they need you, what do? You drop everything. I'll be right there. When my kid's school calls, hey Keith, your son or your daughter is sick. I mean, I drop everything. I don't care if I'm in a meeting. I don't care where I am. I drop everything and I go get my kids. And they're just sick with a cold maybe, but I drop everything to get them. But Jesus waits 2 days. It just seems so weird if not cold. Hey, Jesus, the guy you love, he's sick. He's about to die. He's in massive pain. I love him so much. I'll get to him when I can, though. It's weird. Jesus is in no hurry. He doesn't rush off to see his friend Lazarus. He waits 2 days. And if you've been a Christian for any length of time, you know how this works, don't you? I mean, God's timetable is typically not as urgent or instant-driven as my timetable tends to be. And that doesn't mean he's absent. That doesn't mean he's less loving. Oh, he still loves you. He still cares for you. He's just taking his time. His timetable is typically different than ours, which can be frustrating, but it's also good. This waiting, it forms us. And friends, this two-day gap is not just incidental information. The Bible deliberately points out Jesus waited 2 days. So he waits 2 days, and then verse 7, finally he says to the disciples, let's go back to Judea, which is the region where Lazarus and his sisters are in. Now remember, last time I told you, when Jesus was in this region, the religious people tried to kill him. This is not a safe place for Jesus anymore. And so the disciples, they object. In verse 8, they say to Jesus, but Rabbi, a short while ago the Jews tried to stone you. Why are we going back now? Jesus answers, I'm needed, and so I'm going. Which is weird again. If he knows he's needed, why did he wait 2 days? I just find it so weird. So one of Jesus' disciples, Thomas, says, well, let us also go so that we may die with him. Let's just say, Thomas is not known for his optimism in the New Testament. But they go. They're not thrilled to go, but they go. In verse 17, on his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus has already been in the tomb for 4 days. You see, Jesus took his sweet old time to get there. In the meantime, his friend has died. His sisters Mary and Martha, they're surrounded by friends and family. They're in deep mourning. And Martha goes out to meet Jesus. And in verse 21, Martha says to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. The New Living Translation puts another word in there. It says, Lord, if only you had been here. It's a very heartbreaking statement. Jesus, if only you had been here. If only. And everybody in this room has asked those kind of questions, right? The if only questions. If only I hadn't said those words. If only I made a wiser choice. If only I'd gone to the doctor sooner. If only I had told them I love them. But only I told them I forgive them. I mean, everybody in this room has the if onlys, don't we? And sometimes our if onlys feel like the end of the story. Sometimes our if onlys feel like that's it. Story's over. But they're not over because there's someone we can bring our if onlys to. And Martha brings her if onlys to Jesus. Jesus, if only you had been here. You get this sense in Martha, there's some disappointment with Jesus. Do you see that? There's some disappointment with God in Martha's statement. And I think we see in this, it's okay. It's even expected and good. It's really good to bring these kind of doubts and frustrations to God, even if they're frustrations with God himself. Jesus, if only you had been here. She's frustrated with Jesus. You can bring those things to Christ. You can bring them to him. Jesus, if only you had stopped the abuse earlier. Jesus, if only you had intervened in the car wreck 3 seconds earlier. Jesus, if only you had changed the outcome of the test results. And I think God is okay with these if-only statements. He really is okay. He's fine with these questions. I mean, Lazarus is losing his life to sickness. His two sisters try to keep him alive until Jesus can get there. But Jesus no-shows. He doesn't show up and Lazarus dies. And then Martha, she's honest with Jesus and says, if only you had been here. But then Jesus says to Martha, verse 23, your brother will rise again. And Martha, being the good religious person, gives a good Christian church answer. Oh yeah, I know. That one day, the resurrection, I know. He will rise when everyone else rises in the last day. It's a good church answer. I know about our hope in the resurrection. I know. And then Jesus makes a statement. It's one of the most remarkable statements in all of Scripture. Jesus said to her in verse 25, no, Martha, you're missing it. I am the resurrection, and I am the life. Anyone who believes in me will live even after dying. Everyone who believes in me, everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this, Martha? Do you believe this? Do you believe I am the resurrection and the life? Do you believe this? And I want to pause for a moment. Because Easter Sunday, we typically just read these statements. We go, yes, it's Easter again. It's Easter. And we just glance over these. But this is a staggering claim. This is a staggering claim by Jesus. I mean, imagine if for a moment you're in their shoes. Imagine you have a relative, okay? You have a loved one. He gets really, really sick. Your loved one is on death's bed in the hospital. And so you call the church office. You get a hold of me. You say, hey, Keith, Pastor Keith, you know, my brother, my son, my friend is really, really sick. They're on death's bed. Would you please come and pray for them, Keith? And I respond. And I say, yeah, I love them too, and I'll be right there. But I don't make it until after your loved one dies. And then you find out later, I spent 2 days lingering at Starbucks or Home Depot or taking my time or working out in the Crocs. And I got 2 more days of workout before I go do that. You'd be pretty ticked off, wouldn't you? You'd be upset. You'd at least be disappointed. Keith, I wish you would have come earlier and prayed with us. I mean, I wish you would have come earlier and prayed. I mean, maybe God would have heard the prayer. I don't understand what's going on, but maybe my relative would have been healed. Maybe. And then imagine the audacity if I came 2 days late. Imagine if I said this, though. Fear not. Don't be afraid. I, Keith, am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? What would you do? This is not a trick question. You would change churches. Easy answer. You'd be concerned. If you ever hear a preacher say, I, preacher, and the resurrection and the life, you run. But Jesus says that. And he said to Martha, and he still asks us today, to you and to me, do you believe this? Do you believe that I, Jesus, am the resurrection? Do you believe that I, Jesus, am the resurrection? But he goes on to also say, do you also believe that I am the life? He says that true life is only found in him. Not just resurrection, but true life is only found in Jesus. Jesus says a lot of things like this. He says things like, I am the resurrection and the life. But he also says things like, I am the bread of life. He says things like, I am the light of the world, or I am the good shepherd, or I am the way and the truth and the life. And in each of these statements, Jesus basically says that life with him is where true life begins and where true life is found. And by the way, the next 7 weeks at Riverside, we're going through these 7 statements that we see in the Gospel of John where Jesus says audacious statements, I am the light of the world. And so when Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life, he's claiming to have authority over life and death. And he's saying there's no life apart from him. There's no resurrection. There's no conquering of death apart from him. And in the midst of Martha's pain and her doubt, Jesus looks right at her and he makes this claim about himself. And he asks her the one question that needs to be asked. And just to settle the moment, he says, do you believe this? Do you believe this? And I got to imagine Martha, don't think about this. She's got to be exhausted, right? She's exhausted. She has been caring for her brother who's dying. She's been mourning and grieving now for 4 days. We'll find out it's been 4 days. But Jesus takes her and he refocuses her attention, not on her circumstances, not on her loss, and not on her grief, and not on her pain. He refocuses her attention on him. On himself. Do you believe in me? Because I, Jesus, am the resurrection and the life. So if you believe in me, there's no need for concern. I'll take care of everything. And I love her answer. She's exhausted. She's spent. She's asked some doubting questions. If only you had been here. But she says to Jesus, yes, Lord. In light of everything I've gone through, in light of all this pain, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God who has come into the world. And friends, I got to press you on this one. Do you believe that? I mean, do you really believe what Jesus said? And there's an awful lot riding on this question. There's a lot of life to be lived now based on this question. There's a whole eternity riding on who Jesus is. And so then after Martha makes this declaration, she goes and gets her sister Mary. She goes off and tells Mary, "Mary, the teacher is here. He wants to see you too." So verse 29, the sister number two, Mary, she got up quickly. She went to him. And I love this. Mary also shares her pain and disappointment with God. When Mary arrived, when Mary saw Jesus, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if only you had been here. If you had been here, if you had showed up, if you had moved, my brother would not have died. If only." And Jesus is deeply moved by this. He's deeply moved by this. And we're going to see a lot of emotions in Jesus. Jesus is not some stoic, "Verily, verily, I say unto thee," kind of guy. No, Jesus is moved. He's emotional. Look at this, verse 33. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who come along her were also weeping, Jesus was deeply moved in spirit, and he was troubled. We get this sense, if you look at the original language, that Jesus is he's moved, he's troubled, but he's also angry. He's frustrated. There is this frustration, this tension, even this anger inside of Jesus. And I don't think he's mad at Martha. And I don't think he's mad at Mary. I think he's mad and agitated at death itself. You see, death is our enemy. That's what 1 Corinthians chapter 15 says. Death is what wages war against us. And friends, I hate to tell you, no matter what you do, I don't care how much you exercise or how many vitamins you take or if you buckle up when you drive, I don't care how long or how hard you fight, it sure seems like death always wins, doesn't it? We all will die at some point. And I'm actually like glad that Jesus seems to be agitated at death, aren't you? Jesus is agitated and troubled at death. He doesn't look upon death and go, no big deal. Lazarus died, whatever. He doesn't do that. I've been to many funerals. I've heard some preachers say some pretty stupid things at funerals before. You ever heard a preacher say things like, "We should all accept that death is a natural part of life, that death is just part of life cycle"? That is the dumbest, most ridiculous statement I think you can make. Death is not natural. Death is not normal. Death is not the way God created the world to be. When my grandparents died, when my cousin Charlie died, when two of my close friends committed suicide, one in high school and one in college. As a pastor, I've officiated 14 funerals. I've put 14 people in the ground as a pastor. And let me tell you, don't you dare tell me that death is natural. Death is not natural. Everything inside me screams how unnatural death is. Death is just a natural part of life. That statement pisses me off. It just does. And honestly, I think it ticks God off as well. I think it ticks him off as well. It makes Jesus, this anger well up with him, and he's deeply troubled because death is not the way God created the world to be. And I love the fact that when Jesus comes to the tomb of Lazarus, he's agitated, he's angry, he's troubled with death. And then in verse 34, we get the shortest verse of the Bible. Then Jesus wept. Jesus wept. He starts to cry. He bursts into tears. He's so sad, he cries. Now, why does Jesus do this? Spoiler alert, if you don't know how this thing ends, he's about to raise Lazarus from the dead. Lazarus is going to be just fine. He's going to raise him from the dead, okay? And Jesus probably knows this by now. He's like, "They don't know what I'm about to do." So why is he crying? Why does grief pour out of him? And friends, this is a very important part of the story as well. Because in this you get a glimpse into God's heart. You get a glimpse into the greatness of God's heart. Friends, a couple days after this event, Jesus will stand outside Jerusalem. He's going to weep again. He's going to look at the same city and think of all the people who live there and worry and fear and doubt and are trapped in their sin. He'll look out on the city and say how much he loves them, how he longs to embrace them, how they won't let him embrace him. And he will weep again days later. Friends, this is the heart of God. God's heart is a heart of love, of love. He's got a heart for people who are confused or stubborn or discontent or are too busy and they're missing out on life with God right now. And they're headed for their graves and for eternity without ever saying yes to a God that would die to embrace them. And so he weeps. He weeps. He weeps for them. He weeps for you. He weeps for me. But then he stops weeping. He stands at the face of the tomb where Lazarus was buried. A tomb just like the tomb that where millions of people have been buried before. And Jesus says this, take away the stone. And here it comes. This is the big moment. God's going to do something big. But Martha chimes in, but Lord, by this time there's a bad odor. I mean, he's been there for 4 days. I don't know if you know anything about Martha from elsewhere in the Bible. She's a very practical woman, right? A meticulous host. Martha knows as soon as they remove the stone from the grave, it's going to stink. It's going to be unpleasant for everybody, so she protests. And by the way, this four-day statement is there for a reason. There was this common Jewish folk belief, the folk belief in the Jewish culture back then, that the soul departed would hang around the body for 3 days trying to get back in. But by day four, decomposition would have advanced to the point where there'd be no hope, and so the soul would leave. It was a Jewish folk belief. Also, in that part of the world, it's a desert climate. So inside of a grave after 4 days in a desert, the smell, it's going to be bad. And the point that the Bible's trying to make here is that Lazarus is really dead. He's really dead. There's no doubt. He's been in the grave for 4 days. Then verse 40, Jesus says, did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? I imagine the drama at this moment. All the wailing stops. Everybody stands still. The stone is rolled away. Then Jesus looks up and he says, Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this before the people standing here so that they may believe that you sent me. The stone is rolled away. Jesus has this big prayer. Yet nothing happens. Nothing's moved inside. The people are probably looking around going, Jesus, you prayed. What's going on? And then Jesus calls out in a loud voice. Some translations say he shouted. Shouted. Do you know why he shouted? Do you know why? I have no clue either. I have no idea. Maybe dead people don't hear well. I have no clue why he shouted. None. Not in the Greek either. But Jesus shouts, Lazarus, come out. The dead man comes out, his hands and his feet are wrapped in strips of linen and cloth around his face. I imagine he's standing there like this. Everyone's watching. And Jesus says, hey guys, take the grave clothes. Get him off him. Let him go. I mean, I imagine Lazarus stretching. I mean, his joints are probably pretty tight, right? I mean, you wake up in the morning, if you're like my age now, you're going like, oh, that hurts. Imagine being dead for 4 days. His joints are probably pretty sore. I imagine him saying to Jesus, Jesus, it's been a long week. Ooh, I smell. Woo! I smell pretty funky right now. So Jesus says, clean the guy up. I'm sure Martha went and cooked him a bite to eat. Mary probably just sang and danced. If you know the story of Mary and Martha, she probably just did the Mary thing. But Lazarus came back to life from death. It's amazing. And then what you see next, so after Jesus does this wonderful thing, people have to respond. Their people will respond. And there's really only two responses when it comes to Jesus. There are only two ways when it comes to responding to God. One is you accept him and you trust him and you follow him. We call that worship. You love him, you believe him, you follow him, you thank him, you obey him. It's worship. The other response is you reject him. You disbelieve him. You might even become hostile to him. We'll see those two responses next in the text. I'll go through this real quickly. Verse 45, therefore many of the Jews who'd come to visit Mary had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. That's the first way to respond. You see someone raised from the dead, you believe in them, right? First response. But as amazing as that is, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. But after some discussion, we see in verse 53, so that from that very day on, they plotted to take his life. That's the other way to respond to Jesus. You can reject him. If you read in the text, in between the lines where I just read, you actually see they rejected Jesus because they're so tied to their religion, they miss God. They're so tied to their religion, they miss Jesus. And by the way, friends, this still happens today. There are many friends this morning sitting in churches this Easter, and they are so tied to cultural Christianity. They don't know Jesus. They're just tied to cultural Christianity. They're tied to their religion. They're tied so much to Christianity, they miss Jesus. Friends, we got to be careful, especially if you're a church person, if you're a religious person, if you're a pastor like me. We can become so committed to our traditions and our ways and our politics that we actually unwillingly, not even unknowingly sometimes, we miss Jesus. Some people even just flat out reject Jesus. And in this story, we see there's just these two responses. There's only two responses in this story. What's your response going to be? I also want to point out another thing that happens in this text. It's kind of interesting to me. I find it actually kind of odd. Okay? Here in chapter 11, Lazarus is healed. He's been dead for 4 days. He's healed. It's a miracle. It's amazing. But here's the ironic part. This is so weird to me. In the very next chapter, verse 10, then the leading priests decided to kill Lazarus too. For it was because of him that many people had deserted them and believed in Jesus. I mean, Lazarus is healed. He's raised from the dead in chapter 11, yet he's still mortal. And in the very next chapter, the religious people kill him. That's a long week for Lazarus. I mean, can you imagine the guy? He's like, what? I just died. I got to go through this again? I mean, in other words, the healing and the raising of Lazarus from the dead, that's not the ultimate resurrection story because Lazarus still dies. Very next chapter. That's because the ultimate resurrection story is not Lazarus. The ultimate resurrection story is Jesus' story. Because you see, when Jesus came out of the tomb on Easter, that's when death was finished. Jesus was not subject to death anymore. He had mastered life and he conquered death at that point in his resurrection. He had conquered our greatest foe, which is death. And that is the ultimate resurrection story. Because of that, it means when death comes to someone who's put their trust in Jesus, for somebody who follows Jesus, well, then the grave is not the end. And just as Jesus said to Martha, everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never, ever die, he then asked, do you believe this, Martha? And folks, in the same way, you can have the same hope that Martha had. Jesus is still asking people like you and me, will you trust me? Will you believe in me? Will you live for me? And this is for all of us. Jesus is still asking this question for folks who've been Christians for decades. He's asking also folks in this room who have never said yes to following him. Will you trust me? Do you really believe me? Will you trust that I bring dead things back to life? And in me, true life is found. And friends, this is not out of nowhere. God has always been in the resurrection business. Resurrection and bringing life to dead things is always what God has done. In the Old Testament, we see a little boy named David. He goes up against a giant named Goliath, and David's in massive trouble. He is so small, he can't even handle a sword. And Goliath is this massive man who's moving towards David, certainly to tear the boy apart. And it looks like that's it. David, you are done for it. But he's not, because God is all about resurrection, all about life. In the Old Testament, there's a guy named Daniel. He's thrown into a den of robbers because he refused to stop praying to God. And the authorities of a secular nation throw him into a den of hungry lions. And he's there all night. All night. In the first glance of dawn, the authorities open up the lion's den. And they call down. Of course, if you're in a pit overnight with hungry lions, that is it. Life is over. But because God's all about life and resurrection, it's not. There's a man named Moses. He convinces the nation of oppressed slaves to run away from the most feared and powerful man on earth. When they start to run, though, Pharaoh sets out after them. And they're standing on the shore of the Red Sea. It's in front of them. And the greatest army in the world is behind them. And the people say to Moses, "What were you thinking? We're going to die here." And Moses says, "God, what were you thinking? We're going to die here." But then something happens. Because God's always about life and resurrection. And there have been seasons in my life, where I've been overcome with depression. Where I've been overcome with this grief and sense of loss over a loved one. And I can tell you firsthand, that even the darkest moments of life, God is all about life and all about resurrection. He is the resurrection and the life. And folks, this is the hope of Easter. You see, when Jesus went back down to hostile Judea to bring Lazarus back from the dead, it cost him his life. He went back to the region where he knew if he goes back there, it will kill him. They will kill him, but he'll be able to bring his friend back to life. It's the exchange of life right there. He knew it was going to cost him his life. And on the first Good Friday, they judged Jesus. They mocked him, they whipped him, they beat him, they hung him on a cross to die. They laid him in a tomb to rot away like every other human being has rotted before. I mean, death has entered Jesus' body and that's it. It's done. And they said to everybody, "That's it, guys. Show's over. Time to go home." His people, his friends scatter. But they're wrong. Because God's all about resurrection and all about life. And folks, I don't know what challenges you face. Maybe it's stress at work. Maybe it's a marriage that's falling apart. Maybe your son or your daughter or someone you love is struggling or separated from you. Maybe you have financial pressures. Maybe you've done something that's just eating you on the inside. Maybe you've said the wrong thing or you've made a mistake that's so big you think you can never be redeemed. Or maybe not. Maybe life's going really, really well for you right now. There's no crisis at all, but I hate to tell you guys, last time I checked, the mortality rate's still around 100%. So I don't care whatever you face, whether it's today or tomorrow, the promise of Jesus to everyone who put their trust in him is the hope of Easter. And the reality that God is all about resurrection and he's all about life. Our King Jesus made that very clear once and for all 2,000 years ago, that he has the power to conquer death and the power to give life. And it's still available today. He has risen indeed, and the implications of this are staggering. But how will you respond? How will you respond to implications? Will you respond by saying yes, or will you respond by, no big deal? Friends, we have a really exciting thing this morning. There are five people who this morning want to publicly declare, oh, they're with Jesus. They're saying yes to Jesus. And they're going to do that through baptism. We're baptizing five people this Easter morning. Now I want to tell you, when we baptize them, it's a beautiful picture. If you're getting baptized, come on forward and stand by the baptismal if you would. When people are being baptized, this is a beautiful symbol. Let me look at me right now. This is what happens. They're standing in the water, but they're dry. Like, at least right, their upper part is dry. That symbolizes their old life. And then we dunk them underneath the water. It symbolizes they're going to the grave with Christ. They're dying to themselves. We pull them out of the water. It's a symbol of new life, of new resurrection. Baptism is a life, death, life expression.